Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to look at something that is quite complicated and I think quite obscured by a much bigger story. And that's the changing relationship that the British government had with Britain's colonies during the Second World War. Now, normally the story is about India, and it's about decolonisation, and it's about Britain's various attempts to hang on to her colonies during the war. But actually there's another story to be told. There's a story of a changing relationship that is based on economic necessity. Britain is absolutely desperate to hang on to her colonies because they're enormous sources of manpower and raw materials, and they're huge sources of finance. Britain is indebted to Canada at the end of the war, as she is to the United States. But also, it's less well known that Britain was also indebted to India and a number of the non-Dominion colonies. The manner in which Britain manages those debts is more than a little underhand. Britain manages those debts from London. So instead of being written down as a debt, it was written down as a sterling balance that was not so much a debt from one country to another as a transaction between different parts of the empire, so it doesn't really appear on the balance sheet. It's rather similar to how multinational corporations write checks to different aspects of themselves these days. However, what it did mean is there was a net flow of material and financial resources from India to Great Britain. Now, food production is the fundamental basis of most dealings between colonies and the imperial centre. Great Britain is obviously very keen to make sure that there is a flow of food resources from the colonies to Britain. And there is a view that, well, the colonies have lots of territory, lots of land, and they should be more than capable of producing food for themselves and surpluses for the British under blockade from German U-boats. Kenya is seen as an ideal site. There are lots of white colonist farmers who've lived really the high life in Kenya, colonial cattle ranchers, in essence, and view their work in rearing cattle and, let's face it, in enjoying a rather more peaceful war as really kind of their contribution to the war effort. The reality, however, for black Kenyans is that there were near famine conditions in Kenya during the war. And during the 1930s, Kenya had been encouraged to produce a kind of a surplus, a glut of food, which had driven down agricultural commodity prices, once again providing the empire with cheap foodstuffs, but having serious implications for Kenyan farmers, particularly smaller and more impoverished ones. But the war managed to put various conflicts on hold. The land grab that white colonists had engaged in Kenya, taking over land and throwing the indigenous peoples off it, is temporarily suspended in 1937. The Resident Native Labour Ordinance had been passed, which threatened eviction from traditional tribal lands, normally in the name of the interests of white colonist cattle barons. It's interesting, if you look at some of the films produced about Africa after the Second World War in the 50s and 60s, when places like Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania are the remaining parts of the British Empire. Things such as Born Free, the story of the Adamsons. When you actually look at the rhetoric of people like Joy Adamson, she's constantly referring to the Tanzanian tribes people who'd inhabited her land, or she'd inhabited theirs, really, let's face it. For time immemorial, she's constantly referring to them as squatters, and having them thrown off the land, which she used as a nice nature reserve for leopards and lions and things like that. So it gives you a snapshot as into white colonialist attitudes in Kenya during that time period. The thing that makes life an awful lot easier for Kenyans and Tanzanians and other colonised Africans is the fact that there's an enormous demand for labour, and that once there's a huge demand for labour, and wars always bring this about, tensions between labour and landowners, or labour and managers, or labour and the government tend to decline, because obviously the ordinary workers, the ordinary peasants, have got something of an ace hand to play. And the war years actually gave poorest Africans something of a reprieve from the manner in which they were treated by their colonisers. After 1943, when the prospects for victory start to look up, when Italy's been defeated and things are decisively turning against Germany, and when it looks really as if the defeat in the Far East at the hands of the Americans will only really be a matter of time for the Japanese, the British Colonial Office becomes far more optimistic about the futures of the British Empire. The idea that India would be gone by 1947 really is something of really isn't particularly on their radar. Certainly, this isn't something that Churchill was considering, and so there is a wave of plans drawn up that have had to have been on hold for much of the war, for industrial development across Africa and Asian colonies, of new governmental structures within these colonies. The shock that Britain had in the fall of Malaya and the fall of Singapore and the fall of Burma, really the loss of the crescent in Southeast Asia, which, if you want to read more on, you should read Bailey and Harper's most brilliant books, Forgotten Armies and Forgotten Wars, two absolute gems that I know I've recommended to listeners an awful lot. But the shock of that, and the grassroots political changes that took place as a result of Britain's abject failures to defend the colonies, and the abandonment of those colonies to the Japanese. It wasn't lost on the Malays that and the Burmese that when there was a great white British retreat, the colonial subjects were left behind to fend for themselves. This made colonial office officials think long and hard about the kinds of societies that they were going to re-inherit from the Japanese once they returned. And the answer was, particularly in places like Malaya, that the various sultans and princes had been the first port of call for the British. They had, those are the people that they had gone out of their way to have dealings with, much as the same model for running India. On the assumption that these princes and sultans would then be the people who would enforce rule in their own particular areas. This pre-war system of rulership was going to come to an end. You had an ethnically diverse Malaya that had been hugely brutalised by Japan. This had the departure of the British had led to the development of deep ethnic tensions. The Chinese, Malay Chinese, were seen as synonymous with support for the Malay Communist Party. There were an Indian immigrant population who were treated really quite badly. And the idea that you could return to this old kind of Raj-style government where British administrators used local plenipotentiaries potentates to rule was clearly unworkable. Instead, a more modern system of government was going to have to be needed to put the government, to put the country back together. Also, this is how the British perceived things. The reality, of course, was that the country was not going to return to some kind of colonial plantation system that had been established. In fact, the lives of poor planters who are treated, or poor plantation workers, shall I say, who were treated abominably on the rubber plantations of Malaya, meant that at the end of the war, there was a large number of people who benefited very little from colonial rule, had no role or no place in the colonial system, who were often referred to as squatters, who were looked upon by Malays and by the British with immense suspicion that they might be involved with the communists, and were, in the eyes of colonial administrators, particularly back in London, either a threat to the continued colonisation of Malaya, or evidence of the disastrous short-sightedness of British rule in Malaya. There were some colonial mandarins in Whitehall that thought the best thing to do was to democratise Malaya as quickly as possible and bring these potential threats to British rule into the tent. There were others that believed that a war, which eventually comes, civil war with the communists, was inevitable and desirable, and it was going to be these dispossessed squatters, the poor, who were clustered around plantation estates, who were going to be the main source of succour and comfort to the communists. Britain had its own Malay planning unit from quite early on in the war, and it viewed itself as the kind of the government in exile, and the idea that Britain would be reunited with Malaya was an incontrovertible faith in their eyes. There's a very interesting episode which perhaps tells you a lot about.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate lightweight, super packable travel shoes from Allbirds. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
The prospects for Britain in Malaya. When Britain had a mass amphibious landing that came just after the dropping of the atomic bomb, so following Japan's surrender, the British seized back Malaya, and they had to be seen to be doing it with a show of force, even though the Japanese had kind of already surrendered. Japanese officers who saw the British landing, and bear in mind that this is a year after D-Day, they said, well, it's kind of a good thing we'd already surrendered for your lot, because where we are, we could have mown you all down. And so the British desire to re-establish themselves in Malaya had to be symbolic, and had Britain really had to have fought for Malaya to reconquer it, it would have been incalculably expensive and disastrous, and not least because there was a large part of the multi-ethnic Malay population that was very reluctant to see Great Britain return. The historian Tim Harper on this subject has said that Malaya's post-war renovation was an attempt to replace the confused loyalties of the pre-war period with a sense of allegiance to the colonial state. So what the British hoped to do in Malaya was to take this kind of rather muddled confederation that they'd set up, which had always held together in a slightly Heath Robinson way, and create a unified state which was a colony and also a nation state at the same time. Now, you can always imagine the complexities of doing that. If you have a nation state, the people within that nation state need to identify with it as being sovereign. How do you create a nation state which is also a colony as well? Inevitably, you will have a desire for at least a profound degree of devolution or autonomy. But for the most part, nation states are born in kind of independent struggles, and there is no coincidence that Britain's plans coincide with this upsurgence of Malay nationalism. And it seems, interestingly, as if the things like the fall of Singapore and the kind of the mid-war crises in Whitehall see an old version of the British Empire slip away, and conceptions of a new one emerge. There was an idea that kind of in the old days that Britain had been this kind of rather buccaneering country and had grabbed colonies and done rather bad things to the inhabitants of those colonies. And now the answer wasn't decolonisation and an end to empire, but it was a new, more responsible, more patriarchal and more bureaucratic empire. An empire that was done in a more considered way. And the coincidence of this idea with a development of state planning and bureaucratisation in Britain, you know, the development of a war economy and later a welfare state, are no coincidences. These are no coincidences. There was a national statism developing in Britain and an imperial statism developing across the empire. Unfortunately for those imperial planners, the empire, particularly in Asia, didn't really have much longer to live. Attempts to create a more unified empire couldn't have been more fundamentally undermined in India, for example. The decision by the Viceroy to declare war on behalf of the British Empire without even consulting Congress or any other representative body of the Indian people. The Quit India campaign in mid-1942 and the Bengal famine in 1943 all meant that Britain's hold over India was very, very tenuous by the end of the war. The decision to put the surviving members of Subhas Chandra Bose's Indian National Army on trial, and a podcast is about Chandra Bose and about Britain at the end, the India at the end of the Second World War previously, so if you want to listen to those, they're all back there. These all created crises of allegiance for Indian people, and many decided that they had more time for the Indian National Army, who'd fought alongside the Japanese, than they did for British colonisers. Perhaps it's always a good idea never to set up an ultimatum in an individual for where they are unlikely to choose your side, but that's perhaps by the by. Churchill himself had been a terrible advert for imperial unity. He, being the most ardent of imperialists, was extremely unattractive to India, and particularly when he had made his overtly racist comments about Indians during the Bengal famine. You can always, they're widely circulated, but I won't go into them here. Perhaps a more sympathetic figure was Stafford Cripps, who became Attlee's Chancellor. He'd been Churchill's ambassador to the Soviet Union during the war. Churchill utterly hated him, and he was later sent to India as the head of the eponymous Cripps mission, which attempted to draw Muhammad Ali Jinnah's Muslim League and the Congress into the Viceroy's Executive Council. The Cripps mission doesn't offer independence. It postpones consideration of Britain's withdrawal until after the war. And Gandhi rubbishes the Cripps mission. He calls it a post-dated check from a failing bank. And Cripps was unable to present a compelling shape of a future India that either the British, i.e. Churchill, or the Indians under Gandhi and Nehru were likely to have any interest in at all. Principally, if there was to be independence, under what terms, under where would power lie, which princely states would be able to opt out of a new Indian nation or confederation, what would be the fate of a Muslim state or Muslims within a new Indian state. None of this is really fully articulated. And the only hint that Cripps does give is one that makes Gandhi's blood run cold. The idea that possibly there could be opt-out clauses. Cripps doesn't really quite make that clear, but Gandhi sees the division of India right there. However, the failure of the Cripps mission was really a cosmetic compared to the failure of the British to be able to feed Bengal. The breakdown in the distribution of foodstuffs so that the province could eat and survive, and the loss of an estimated 3 million lives meant that British legitimacy in India ended at that point. Without going into the famine itself, because that's a subject of an entirely different podcast, I think. It's a big, big topic area. But the reasons for the famine are, firstly, that Japan's advances into Burma had cut off flows of foodstuffs from Burma to Bengal. The fear that the Japanese might use Bengali boats to cross over into India meant that a lot of the transport along the river Ganges were destroyed, and the priority for Britain was to ensure that foodstuffs were not diverted to deal with starving populations away from vital supplies for armies. The imperial centre and its needs came before the needs of subject peoples. And the point being, I think, that within the British Empire at least, a fair degree of consent was always needed for people to permit themselves to be ruled. There was a reason why Britain was able to rule a large subcontinent like India, and it was that at certain periods of time, there were certain net benefits to certain demographics and political strata within India. The moment that that's gone, the moment that Britain is a net loss for everybody, then Britain's rule over India also evaporates. So as we can see, the British administrative classes in Whitehall had an immense influence and impact over the empire during the war. there were periods where they believed that a new and rejuvenated, perhaps slightly streamlined, British Empire could establish itself after the war. And there were other moments where they saw new conflicts arising. And there were points at which they hoped India, for example, the most important part of the empire, could be retained, and moments where they suspected that certainly wasn't able to happen. Another interesting facet of all of this are changing American attitudes towards the British Empire. The American forces fighting in Burma and China looked upon the British Empire with a great deal of disdain. They saw SEAC, Southeast Asia Command, was nicknamed Saving England's Asian Colonies. And there was, within the American newspaper and radio media and the broader American population, a great deal of resentment, and understandably so, that Americans were fighting and dying to allow the British to retain their colonies. However, at the end of the war, as the possibility of communist takeovers in places like Malaya, Indonesia, and Vietnam presented itself, Harry Truman, successor to Roosevelt, was more than happy for the British to return to, in fact, they returned to all of these places, you know, two of the colonies being former Dutch and former French, to re-establish colonial order as the threat of Stalin in Europe occupies much of Truman's thoughts. And having Britain as a useful regional policeman is really, really quite handy. Obviously, Britain is fatally economically undermined with the end of Lend-Lease and the criteria for the Keynes loan negotiated in August 1945, which causes the currency, the pound, to be fully convertible by 1947. Once that's happened, Britain is effectively bankrupt and cannot afford to police her own colonies and cannot afford to carry out their own little police actions in places like Greece and Turkey, thus ushering in an entirely new phase of American foreign policy. Anyway, I've gone on for far too long, so I'm going to leave you there. I hope you find this useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.